Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Sarah McDooling and I'm here today with Matt Knopf.
Hi.
Hi Matt, you have written a book.
Have I?
You have, well, I
That's
hope
news
so.
To me. Oh, actually. Oh, I must have. There you go.
I'm 5 chapters in. I hope you read
Thank you.
It. It is called Breaking the Ice.
Yep.
And I've just got my hands on a copy today and I've flown through the first chapters and I'm just really, it's really interesting read.
Thank you.
I wondered if you could, I wanted to ask you, you tell a great story at the beginning of the book about how you came to the decision that this book had to be written. Could you tell the podcast listeners a bit about that?
Yeah. So I spent a lot of last year, so 2015, talking about ice in the media, challenging what had been put out by the government around ice. And, you know, the Ice Destroys Lives campaign, but also in the media, stories have been written. For one example was a headline that said, "Ice Zombie Chews Her Own Toes Off." And I suddenly realised that a lot of this had become almost entertainment and unethical. And the compassion for people suffering from drug dependence had been completely forgotten. And I felt the whole issue was being misrepresented. And any time I had a chance to talk to a TV crew or the media about it, I felt like I could never get across the whole point in a soundbite. And so I got to a place where I felt that the thing I really needed to do was write a book about it and go all the way back to the beginning, talk about my own frustrations and then talk about the birth of this drug, which was happened over 100 years ago. And that was it for me. And about that same time, Helen from HarperCollins messaged me and said, "Have you thought about a book?" It was the weirdest thing, especially for an atheist like me. It was very strange, but it was lovely timing.
Well, sometimes it's like you when things like that happen, you just have to believe in some kind of collective conscience. Where it's
something like that. I think, in fact, it's wiser, I think, as Philip Adams would remind me, to probably be instead of an atheist like him, to be agnostic. So we remain,
uncertain
and remind ourselves that it's all a mystery.
Well, on the topic of belief systems, you early on mentioned a creed of your grandfather's that you live by.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about that? Because that really struck me as an amazing idea.
It is an amazing idea, and this is something my grandfather talked about starting in the 60s when he started the Wayside Chapel, the church didn't like it at all. They charged him with heresy about 3 times over it, and it continues to be a really powerful idea, and it's this. He said, "I'm a Protestant, but I'm also a Catholic. I'm a Muslim, but I'm also a Hindu. I'm a Buddhist, but I'm also a Jew. I'm an agnostic, but I'm also an atheist. Because first and foremost, I am a human being, and no one in this world is a stranger to me."
I got chills reading it, and I got chills just then. I just feel like those are some powerful words.
They are, and I think the reason why the church thought it was so dangerous and knew that it was dangerous is because it wasn't limiting. It wasn't exclusive, like everything is in our world these days. It was the opposite. It was the antithesis of that. It was inclusive. It remains inclusive. And today, when we're hearing in the media about asylum seekers, about the war on drugs, about gay marriage, about how we treat Muslims, all of these different topics aim to divide, and it's very easy to do that. It's very easy to divide society and the community. It's much harder, and it's rarer, I should say, to include people, and that's what my grandfather was doing with that.
Well, I wanted to ask you, on the topic of dividing people and just how all of the topics that you just mentioned are so often reported in the media and treated by the government as fearful things that people should be scared and concerned about. What do you think is the greatest misconception about ICE, and how do you feel that that's been sort of contributed to by the government or the media?
First of all, I think most people who use ICE in this country don't have significant issues with the use of it. That's not just me saying it. That's the Australian Crime Commission last year. Okay, most people who use ICE aren't dependent on it. They use it around once a year. Okay, so that's the first thing that most people don't know, even though it was reported in the media. It was almost completely glossed over or forgotten. Of those who do have issues, less than a quarter will end up in hospital suffering from some sort of psychotic episode. And of those who do end up suffering from some sort of psychotic episode, most will be okay. Those that found that obviously have continued episodes, psychotic episodes related to their ICE use would normally have a pre-existing schizophrenia. So these things are really difficult. They're complex kind of areas to navigate, but it's important that we understand what we're seeing when the government puts up an ad like ICE destroys lives. Does ICE destroy lives, or does the narrative that's being put out there destroy lives? Because I've spoken to parents whose kids are dependent on ICE, and they're struggling and they're having a very difficult time, but they feel that they're completely alienated and, again, excluded because of this narrative. It's a really horrible way to present something, and a more ethical way to present it would be to say that there are people out there who really struggle, not just with ICE, but all sorts of drugs. And that's because that many of them are impoverished and they don't have other resources like most of us do to get on with their life. They don't have friends and family to help them get through. So it wouldn't just be the drug that's affecting them. It might be a pre-existing mental health issue. It might be other issues in their life too. So being compassionate is really important, and I think that's the kind of misnomer I was trying to break through or break down.
Well, we were discussing before the podcast an idea that I found really interesting, which you just discussed in a little bit, the idea that drugs are a symptom, not the cause of destroying lives. And that drugs, and the idea of drugs being evil. And he said some amazing things about that. I was wondering if you could expound on that again.
Yeah, I was with some members of the government the other day, and they were saying to me, Matt, you know, our position is that drugs are evil. And I said to them, I would love to have that debate in public, because it's a notion that's easily dismissed. To say that drugs are evil completely forgets about the sorts of drugs that, say, reduce the severity of a cold, can wipe out hepatitis, can reduce the effects of HIV on the body. Drugs can improve lives. And a drug like heroin is a drug that any of us might be given in hospital if we suffered from some sort of accident. And it would be rare, but some of us might go on to form a dependency with that drug, again, if there are other things going on in our life which are mitigating or aren't mitigating things that we might be hurt by, or not having the resources, the family and the friends around us to support us. So when we don't have that support, then it's far easier for us to develop a drug dependency. If drugs are evil, are we saying that a drug user is evil? Are we simply saying that a drug dealer is evil? If we know that drugs themselves aren't evil, it's a very strange place to come to, because more and more we start to realize, again, that being compassionate about this makes more sense. So to call drugs evil is nonsense, and to call a drug user is not being compassionate. Maybe people might think drug dealers are evil, but even a drug dealer, more often than not, most drug dealers are dealing to stay alive and to help their own habits. And certainly what the police have been trying to do, and you can speak to many of them like I have in the book, former police commissioners, federal police commissioners, saying what we're currently doing completely misses the biggest dealers, the ones with accountants and lawyers and high fences. The Dobbin a Dealer campaign is never going to get them. It's only going to get the low-level dealers who are more often than not users as well.
Well, as I said, I've just picked up your book today, and I'm just a few chapters in, but the one thing that is striking me a lot is that this book is full of hope, and it's quite positive. You open the book with a letter from a mother of a daughter who had struggled with an ice addiction and had turned her life around. And as I read it, so that's the first part of the book, and I went into this book having girded my loins to read like a hardcore depressing book about drugs, and I really did think that, what am I going to get myself into here? The more I read, the less I realise I know about this topic. And the more I imagine I'll find out when I continue reading the book, because I've only read such a small part of it. But my question is really, when I read that letter and I just thought, wow, what an amazing way to begin this book. My first question was, oh, but, you know, of the people who have this problem, what percentage have a happy ending and what don't? Like, we hear the horror stories so much more often than we hear the hopeful stories. What are your thoughts on that? Like, do you, in your experience, because you work with so many kids with this problem, is it more people who are able to beat it than not?
Yes. And and I think that's a really important message to get out there. That, put it this way, in a government meeting last year, I sat down with the National Ice Task Force, and someone asked me, what's your success rate with young people? And I said, whoa, that's a tough question. And they said, well, how many kids do you get off drugs? And I said, let me ask you this question instead. If a young person comes into our program and they're using ice and they're smoking pot and they leave just smoking pot, is that success? And they said, yes, that is a success. And I said, well, that happens for more of the kids in our program than not. So if that's what you think success is, we're very successful. But we don't just measure the decrease in drugs, we measure criminality. So over half the young people who leave our programs completely stop having anything to do with crime. Suicidal ideation, where one in two young people come into our programs feeling suicidal, one will still leave, one in 10 will still leave feeling suicidal. But that's a huge drop from one in two to one in 10. This is how I think about our programs. If a young person leaves to go on to live a flourishing life, but they continue to use a drug, whether it's cannabis or ice infrequently, that's what I'm interested in, as opposed to saying, I just want to get a kid off drugs. The government wants a good mortgage-paying citizen, and I say, if we can aim beyond that to help a young person find and live a flourishing life, then we're going to get what we want, the young person's going to get what they want, and the government's also going to get what they want. I think it's setting the bar too low to simply create a young person who has stopped using drugs. So yes, more often than not, the kids completely stop using drugs, but that should not be the aim.
It's more than that.
It's much more than that.
I just, the fact that you are able to say that, though, to me is such a revelation, because the discourse around this subject makes it feel like, you know, if you have ice one time, you will become an ice zombie who eats their toes off, like, that's it, and that you'll never beat it and you'll become a monster and, you know, that's it forever. To hear that is so amazing, and it just really makes me question why you always focus on the horror stories and you never focus on the hopeful stories.
Yeah, this is a story of hope. And you and I know people who take illicit drugs all the time and are not just normal people, but are wonderful human beings. And, you know, I feel that our society is doing the wrong thing. We're doing the wrong thing by each other when we tell lies about this. And certainly our kids need to hear the truth. If my daughters grow up one day to try drugs, you know, I want them to be able to do so without the risk of them becoming dependent on them. I want them to go on to live, again, very happy lives. And the way to do that, I think, from my experience, working with thousands of kids every single year, is to be honest with them, as opposed to saying, say no to drugs, because it doesn't work. It simply doesn't work. So I think we can really help each other by being more truthful about drugs. Certainly, most of us drink alcohol, and that's one of the most dangerous drugs in our society, and we could be doing a much better job managing that. So I think it's time to start a new discourse around drugs, and that's really what the book is trying to do.
Well, just from the section I've read, I can really tell that this is not your average book about drugs. I can tell that because, as I mentioned, we start with a letter that really is emotional to read. Yeah. And then you move from that into what is quite a funny chapter one. Like, it's like when it's not what you expect when you start reading a book to find yourself chuckling, where you tell the story about having to do an interview about ice at a child's birthday party and, you know,
my neck bleeding.
Yeah, I was laughing and I'm like, what have I picked up? It's not what I expected. And then you move straight from that into a fascinating history of ice. And so it really is, you're looking at it from all the angles, you're treating the seriousness seriously, but you're finding lighthearted moments as well. Like, I'm just like, I'm really impressed and keen to start reading. But my question, which it took me a while to get around to, is that in that story, you mentioned that the reporter asks you a question and you worry that you aren't able to answer it with just a simple soundbite. So I wanted to ask you the question again and give you the space to answer it properly.
Challenge.
Yeah, so the question is, and I've written it down, here it is, why do you think ice pipes should be regulated and not banned?
Oh, God.
Take it away.
Now that my neck's not bleeding, or if it was, it wouldn't matter because no one can see. The reason why we need to start looking and really experimenting with whether ice pipes should be regulated is because what we found in the 90s was with the spread of HIV and hepatitis, it was the sharing of needles. And you've got a much reduced risk with ice pipes, but there's still sharing going on. So if someone has a crack on their lips and they're sharing pipes and there can be the spread. You can find possibly a spread of hepatitis, but we have not done enough research to find an evidence base whether that would work if we regulated and certainly gave people ice pipes as well in services so they could use one pipe and start doing messaging around that. It's worth it to me. From my point of view, it's really worth starting to find out whether we should be doing that. And the only way that we do that is to start a conversation about it. So the government says, this is probably a good idea, because the spread of hepatitis isn't just in the interest of those inhaling ice. It's in the interest of the whole community.
I need to talk about a bit later in the book that I haven't read, but I noticed it in the contents that you touch on Breaking Bad.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much everything I know about crystal meth before I picked up your book would have come from that show.
Yeah.
And the title of the chapter is, did it increase ice use or not? Are you able to, like, I mean, I'll
get
there.
You want to know.
I want to know the answer.
Do you know how long that chapter is?
How long is
it's
it?
It's like 2 pages.
Oh, seriously?
It's 2 pages. We could read it right now. I don't think I should tell you. I don't think I should tell you. I think you should go and read that because it's only 2 pages and it's really interesting. And let me tell you this.
Yeah.
I wanted to know because a lot of people ask me, did that show increase ice use? Okay. So I went out to research this myself and I went and looked and I compared the data and I looked at when the show was on and the rest of it. And I come to the conclusion at the end of that chapter. It's only 2 pages.
So you have to read it to find out.
You have to read it.
There we go. Oh my gosh. I'm now going to have to try and force myself to not skip ahead and read that chapter. I want to just get there. And
do you know what? Honestly, I wrote this book so you could do that. We formulated in the way so you could open it up to a page and you don't feel like you have to read it. You know, please don't feel like you have to read it from the beginning to the end. It really is one of those things you can pick up and go, oh, that's interesting. And that's why HarperCollins as well kind of put the titles in those places so you can kind of pick up and take it where you find it. So I have no issue with you going straight to the Breaking Bad chapter.
Guess what I'll be doing as soon as the podcast finishes. Yeah. Another thing I found really interesting in the book is that you go through the history of ice, which is something I never even thought about, and I was quite fascinated to know about it.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
It is.
Without, obviously, going through everything because we don't have time, and also it's in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because
So, again, I was really interested in finding out where this drug came from, and I'd heard that it was Japan. And what I found was just became so remarkable that I was even saying to the team at HarperCollins, I was like, oh, I felt like I found this thing. And it's so unbelievable that it was almost hard to write because it felt like something from a comic book strip. And it is a remarkable history, the birth of ice. The birth of methamphetamine is over 100 years ago, and then of ice nearly 100 years ago. And it spread through and then into World War II with people like Hitler being dependent on it. It doesn't seem true, and yet this is something that's been studied by academics all over the world. And allegedly even JFK was dependent on ice, it's a really remarkable history, and I couldn't believe it when I started to write this, and I was researching and I was getting down into the nitty gritty. I could not believe it. And as I was saying to you before, when I went up to my wife to read her, the chapters around this. At first, she admitted that she thought it was going to be really boring. And she, at the end, she was like, that is incredible. She said, it's almost bizarre. So, it's a very interesting history, you know, coming from Japan and then into World War II, where not just the Nazis, but the Allies were also using it after they found out the Nazis were on it, and then the kamikaze and then being in Moonraker and James Bond, and it's a really interesting history. So I felt very lucky writing about it.
Well, and it's stuff that I'd just never heard of. If you'd asked me yesterday, I would have just thought methamphetamine invented in a lab somewhere in the 90s. Like, that's what I would have thought.
Yes, exactly.
And I think a lot of people have that idea. Also think a lot of people, this might speak a bit more to my own ignorance, so I don't want to generalize and say a lot of people think this, but personally, I found really interesting when you went through all the different types of methamphetamine, because I don't think a lot of times I connect these things in my mind. Like, I don't connect speed with crystal meth. I think of them as sort of separate different things.
And so funnily enough, 10 years ago, speed wasn't what speed is today. So 10 years ago, when we referred to speed in Australia, we were talking about amphetamine. That's now changed to the powder form of methamphetamine, which is the stage before we synthesize it to make ice. So it is. It's really interesting.
And then base as well.
Yeah. So there's all different forms, and in there we go into detail about what we use now in Australia more than anything else, and it's mostly crystal meth ice. What we refer to, and of course, when we hear about what ICE is in the media, they're actually referring to methamphetamine. So they're referring broadly, to all, broadly. Yeah. You know, so ICE technically, very technically from a street point of view, is just crystal meth, not methamphetamines altogether. So yeah, like you said, there's base. There's the powdered forms, and there's amphetamines. You know, there's all sorts of different drugs that, that often get conflated by the way the government sells it as well, like in the ICE Destroys Lives. You know, it's interesting. I mean, no one's ever really seen that before from the government. They you know, if they were technically going to present it in the right way, they would say methamphetamines destroy lives.
I never even thought about... Previous to reading your book, if someone had asked me about that campaign, those ads that came out, I would just sort of thought, oh, you know, it's disturbing and drugs are evil. You know, and that they were everywhere for a while and then they just went. And I don't think anyone would watch those ads and feel that it relates to their lives. I don't think anyone would watch those ads and feel like that it's a problem they have to worry about.
Because
it's presented that these people...
The other.
Are monsters, yeah.
Yeah, they're the other. And I guess that's what I started to really tap into was that it was being presented as entertainment. It was entertainment. There's no other way around it. But newspapers were selling it on that idea that zombie chews her own toes off, and these people are taking over our cities and all the rest of it. And it's just, and I started to think, this is getting not just out of hand, but it's wrong, and
and who does it help?
Who does it help? It doesn't help anyone. It's really hurting people.
Well, if you could, for anyone struggling with an ICE addiction themselves, or anyone who has a friend or a family member who is struggling, if you had to, for some, I don't understand the circumstances that would make you only give them one piece of advice, but if it had to just be one, what would it be?
Well, I think most of us, all of us, know someone who is struggling with drugs. All of us do. I don't know anyone who doesn't. All of us know someone, knows a family who is. And I think the most important thing is I couldn't just give one piece of advice, but the one piece of advice to start with would be we need to treat that person compassionately, because it could be us. Secondly, to change the discussion and the national discourse around this from one of criminalizing these people to helping them, because filling our jails with people who are dependent on drugs is cruel. They can get drugs far easier in jail than they can on the street, so that's wrong and that needs to change. And thirdly, help them get into a treatment service. If they're an adult, there are amazing services out there, like We Help Ourselves is one, Odyssey House, the Salvation Army run them. And then there's also a fantastic service run by a man who lost his son to heroin. His name is Tony Trimmingham, and he runs a service called Family Drug Support, and he can help families. And of course, if you know someone who has a young person who's struggling with drugs, you can talk to us at NOFS Foundation. So unfortunately, that wasn't one piece of advice. But
one was it was a hard ask.
But yeah, it's a few in there.
Can I ask what's up next for you and the foundation as well?
We're starting another book now for HarperCollins, which I'm really pleased about. I think it will be just as exciting as this one, I'm not going to tell you what that is.
We have to wait.
Yeah.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming in today. It's been such a pleasure to meet you and talk to you. And podcast listeners, Matt's book, Breaking the Ice, is available online at Booktopia.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.